Coca-Cola revives and sustains. Things go better with Coke. I'd like to buy the world a Coke. It's the real thing. Enjoy Coca-Cola. With help from these and dozens of other slogans, Coca-Cola has become a global phenomenon. The soft drink was first marketed as a patent medicine, then as a refreshing pick-me-up, then as something to drink with meals or after meals or at any conceivable time and place. Mark Pendergrast published his history of Coca-Cola 20 years ago, a history of a relentless effort to sell a simple product as widely as possible, come what may. That book, For God, Country, and Coca-Cola, is now in its third revised edition. I'm Jim Meadows, and Mark Pendergrast is my guest today on Focus. We'll talk about everything from the reputed secret formula to how a sugary soda survives in an age of bottled water. Have a Coke with Mark Pendergrast on Focus after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows.
It's a real thing. Coke is.
And for the record, I am sipping from a Diet Coca-Cola I bought this morning at the Coca-Cola vending machine at the WILL break room. I can do this because Coca-Cola is everywhere, as my guest Mark Pendergrast will explain. Like Coca-Cola, Mark was born and raised in Atlanta, Georgia, and he's written books ranging from the investigation of epidemic diseases to the history of coffee. For God, Country, and Coca-Cola was published in 1993, revised in 2000, and revised and expanded for a third edition, now available in trade paperback from Basic Books. Mark Pendergrast, welcome to Focus.
Hi, glad to be here.
Well, we're all used to seeing Coca-Cola around. How big is Coca-Cola today, really, compared to other drink brands? How do its rivals compare, for that matter?
Well, Coca-Cola, you know, it used to be everybody talked about the cola wars with Pepsi. A couple of years ago, when Diet Coke surpassed Pepsi to become the second biggest selling soft drink in the United States behind Coca-Cola itself, a lot of people declared the cola wars were over. I don't think they're over exactly, but Coke dominates Pepsi both in the U.S. and worldwide. Just to put it in perspective, Coca-Cola is the single most widely distributed product on Earth. It's available in every country other than North Korea and Cuba, and that's only because our government won't let them be there legally, and of course you can get it on the black market. So it's really a remarkable saga of how that came to be when, you know, it was invented not all that long ago in terms of human kind, you know, about 127 years ago.
That's something that struck me, that soft drinks, not just Coca-Cola, but all soft drinks are so common today. But from what I read in your book and elsewhere, Coca-Cola and other such beverages are not that old. And the strangest thing to me is that they evolved from patent medicines. How did that happen?
Well, in the late 90s, there are a variety of things I could say to that. One is that if you went to a doctor, it was pretty dangerous in those days. They were likely to give you mercury, which is a poison, or bleed you, or put hot cups on you to raise blisters and then break them. So it wasn't really a very charming prospect. Drugs were perfectly legal and widely accepted. It wasn't until the Harrison Anti-Narcotic Drug Act was passed in 1914 that any drug became illegal. So you had all these, quote, nerve tonics, which were supposed to make you better. And Coca-Cola originally was supposed to cure headaches and hangovers, and it also cured neurasthenia, which was sort of the disease du jour of the time. It was sort of a mythical disease. The idea was that you had a limited amount of nervous energy, and that if you were a refined, delicate woman or a high-powered businessman, you would deplete that energy, so you needed a nerve tonic such as Coca-Cola.
Okay, and as I read in your book, Coca-Cola was developed by a pharmacist named John Pemberton. He had actually started with a wine, let me get this right, a wine and cocaine product, which was a knockoff.
That's right. You've actually been reading my book. This is so exciting.
Well, it's a big book, but it's a fascinating book. And he started with a wine and cocaine product, which was a knockoff of another product.
I love this. This is my favorite part of the book, actually. I discovered that there was a drink called Vin Mariani, you know, wine of Mariani. It was made by a Corsican named Angelo Mariani in Paris. And it was also, he had a manufacturing plant in New York City as well. And it was incredibly popular and famous. And he had celebrity endorsements from Queen Victoria and Pope Leo XIII and Thomas Edison and Emile Zola. They all drank Vin Mariani, which was a Bordeaux wine with an infusion of coca leaf, meaning it had cocaine and alcohol. And so John Pemberton, this very, very smart and quite a knowledgeable pharmacist in Atlanta, made a Vin Mariani knockoff, as many people did. And his was called French Wine Coca. And what happened was Coca-Cola probably would never have come into being had it not been that Atlanta voted to go dry in the fall of 1885. They voted that as of July the 1st, 1886, alcohol would be illegal within the city limits. So Pemberton frantically modified French Wine Coca to take out the alcohol, and it was kind of bitter. He added a bunch of very interesting essential oil flavorings and a whole bunch of sugar to make it palatable. And that's what Coca-Cola is. The irony is that French Wine Coca was never banned because it continued to be available as a, quote, medicinal beverage, which a lot of alcoholic beverages were.
But the original Coca-Cola product did contain cocaine.
Oh, yes.
And enough to make a difference if you drank a glass?
If you drank one glass, it certainly was a very small amount of cocaine. Because it's a natural ingredient of the drink, because it was made from the actual leaves of the coca plant imported from Peru and made into a fluid extract. So they never put in white powder, although subsequently, you know, various users did dump it into it. But original Coca-Cola was not that potent. It had twice as much caffeine as it has now. But if you took five or six glasses in a row, you would get pretty much of a street hit of cocaine, and many people did just that. So it was addictive, and it did have a little cocaine kick to it.
Now, you know, I went to the Coca-Cola corporate website and read all sorts of things about Coca-Cola, not much about cocaine in its history.
surprise.
This is the most I could find. A little article from their chief historian, Phil Mooney, the Coca-Cola chief historian, dated from
retired, actually. Yeah.
Okay. Well, this was from just last January, and the main part of his article was answering a New York Times op-ed piece, which made charges of past racism by the company. But in the midst of doing that, he writes, Phil Mooney does, first off, Coca-Cola does not contain cocaine, and cocaine has never been an added ingredient for Coca-Cola.
Well, you know what he means? He's parsing it very finely. What he means is they never added in white powder. Ask him if it ever had fluid extract of coca leaf in it.
So it had coca leaves in it. Does Coca-Cola still have coca leaves in it?
It does.
Okay, but
it does. But they decocainized the coca leaves in a chemical plant in Maywood, New Jersey, and they've done that ever since 1903. So they actually had a little tiny, tiny, tiny bit of cocaine still in it until the late 20s, which they discovered to their horror. But as far as I know, it has absolutely no cocaine in it now.
But they still have.
It does use coca leaf.
But they still have the coca leaf. Is the coca leaf without cocaine necessary for the product? I mean, does it affect? Is it a flavor agent?
You know, I think it is, but I, you know, I'm not a chemist. Even if it weren't, I think they would keep it in it because, it's funny, it's ironic that in 1911, the United States government sued Coca-Cola and almost put them out of business. And one of the things they were suing over was that it was mislabeled because it no longer had real fluid extract of coca leaf in it. They had taken the cocaine out. So I think that they just don't want to mess with that formula. And also, they were taught a big lesson in 1985 when they came out with New Coke, which did not have coca leaf in it. They were trying to get away from that because it's sort of been a plague to them. And it's a pain to, you know, they've had to have lobby hard for political exceptions to be allowed to have coca leaf imported legally into the United States just so they can make it.
They're the only cola drink that has coca leaves, at least in the U.S., I take it.
Yeah, I think it is, yeah.
Does right. Coca-Cola...
Although I've run into various literature about people who wanted to get an exception so that they, too, could use decocainized coca leaf. And oddly enough, the U.S. government is almost, you know, it's almost like in league with Coca-Cola to have a monopoly, which Coke also had a monopoly of sorts during World War II, which is another really interesting piece of their story.
One more question about the ingredients. The other part of the Coca-Cola name is cola for the cola nut, the source of the caffeine. Is that still the source of the caffeine in Coca-Cola?
No, and it hasn't been the main source almost from the beginning. They use spent tea leaves to get the caffeine out of, I believe. But you're right. It's interesting. You know, what's fascinating about this drink is it's really quite an international beverage. It's all natural, at least unless you put in artificial sweetener. But it came from Peru. The cola nuts came from West Africa where they were chewed for their drug effect, which was caffeine. And a lot of other ingredients came from all over the world, you know, oil of cassia, which is a Chinese cinnamon, and a variety of other essential oils, some of them coming from the perfume industry.
Well, this is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. We're talking with writer Mark Pendergrast, author of For God, Country, and Coca-Cola, and his history of Coke and the company that makes it is now out in a third revised and expanded edition for basic books. If you have questions and comments about Coca-Cola and the soft drink industry, call us at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455, or you can email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number again is 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL, and you can also contact us on Twitter or Facebook at Focus580. Now, Coca-Cola had its start as a medicinal drink that was sold at soda fountains in drugstores, and I assume that in the early years, people who went to soda fountains expected something from these various carbonated tonics. But over the course of the 20th century, Coca-Cola became something else entirely, at least in terms of how it was marketed. Can you give us a little quick view of what happened to Coca-Cola's marketing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, pretty quickly after it was invented in 1886, and I should mention John Pemberton died in 1888. It turns out he was a morphine addict. That's one of the reasons he was interested in cocaine, which he thought was harmless and would help his addiction. A guy named Asa Candler took over the company. But it was really Frank Robinson, who I call the unsung hero. He's the one who named Coca-Cola when he was a partner with Pemberton. He convinced Candler to get hold of it in somewhat shady ways, including some forgeries, I believe. But it was also Frank Robinson who advertised it. And by 1895, he found that particularly women were writing to him and saying, would you please reassure us that we don't need to be sick in order to take this, because we like it, and we don't want to have to pretend it's a medicine. So he began to change the advertising. From the beginning, it had said it was delicious and refreshing, but it did all these other things for you. Now he began to emphasize the delicious and refreshing part more. It was a gradual process. When Robert Woodruff took over the company in 1923, after his father had arranged a consortium of bankers to do a $25 million buyout in 1919, biggest deal in the South at that point. Robert Woodruff was a very clever guy, and he said, we're not going to do any more defensive advertising. We're not going to say all the things it does good for you. No more medicine, no more negative. Everything is going to be uplifting and good. And he hired an ad man named Archie Lee, who came up with the pause that refreshes, this idea that became very popular during the Depression years, that Coca-Cola was a little, tiny, nice thing you could do for yourself. It was kind of an affordable luxury. It was only a nickel a drink for many, 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 many years. And that was the main thrust of their ads. It became, they wanted also to overcome this stigma that it had from early on. As I mentioned, the U.S. government had sued them. It had been banned on army bases in the 19-teens briefly. So they wanted to paint it as this all-American, patriotic, good-for-you, wholesome beverage, and they succeeded very much in doing that, so that by World War II, it had become a symbol of the American way of life.
Now, this is what happened with Coca-Cola. Were similar things happening elsewhere in the soft drink industry? Because it seems like there were other beverages that started out with some medicinal claims, which became, I guess, recreational beverages. Was this an industry-wide thing?
Yeah. Heyer's root beer actually predated Coca-Cola, and Moxie was another drink that predated Coca-Cola.
I just had a bottle of Moxie for the first time the other day, and, you know, it still tastes medicinal.
Well, I love the story behind that. It was invented by a guy named Augustus Thompson in Lowell, Massachusetts, but he made up Lieutenant Moxie, who had discovered this wonderful beverage in South America, blah, blah, blah. It was all total BS, but that's what he made up. Anyway, yeah, lots of them were like that. But many, many of the soft drinks were imitations of Coca-Cola because it was so popular, including Pepsi, but many, many others. And Pepsi went almost bankrupt several times, and Coca-Cola refused to buy them out when it could have. During the Depression, the guy who got hold of Pepsi, whose name was Guth, decided to bottle it in 12-ounce recycled beer bottles and to charge a nickel for it. And it was a lousy drink. But it was twice as much for a nickel, which they made a big deal out of. And so if you were really, really poor, you drank Pepsi. And Coke was very lofty and arrogant and refused to pay attention to this upstart Pepsi. In fact, for many years, no one inside Coca-Cola would say the word Pepsi. They called them the imitator or the contender. But they would never say the P word.
Well, let's say the P word here. I have an old jingle, and this is actually from, I think, an ad that played at movie theaters in the 1940s. Okay, and that featured a couple of comic animated policemen who saved a couple of young ladies who were on a runaway toboggan fortified with Pepsi Cola. But I heard the line in the jingle, 12 full ounces, that's a lot, twice as much for a nickel, too, which seems to have been, as you said, their main selling point.
Yeah, that was actually the first popular jingle on radio in the late 1930s. And it really changed the way ads were. Many of them had been like a minute or 2 minutes long. This was a very short little jingle, and it was contagious. And many, many people know it. So that launched Pepsi in a big way, that twice as much for a nickel, too. But it also gave it a downscale image. Oh. So Just if you want to keep things in order, we should probably talk about this World War II chapter. Did you get to that one?
Yes, and Coca-Cola did a lot of traveling in World War II, I take it.
It did. I mean, what happened was right after Pearl Harbor, Robert Woodruff, the CEO of Coca-Cola, said, "We will get a Coca-Cola to our fighting men wherever they are, no matter what it costs us, for only a nickel a drink, as we always have." Very patriotic. But what it did, eventually, after he had all of his lobbyists working overtime in Washington, was Coca-Cola was exempted from sugar rationing for use by the military. Not only that, Coca-Cola men were deemed, were called technical observers, which was a designation given to civilians who were essential to the war effort, usually people who repaired airplanes or something. And Coke men were put in Army uniforms with TO, for technical observer, on their shoulder, sent overseas, and at government expense, they put in 64 bottling plants during World War II to supply the soldiers with this essential morale booster that would remind them of home and remind them of what they were fighting for. And as absurd as this may seem, if you read some of the letters that the company got, it did. It really was.
I take it, say, Pepsi-Cola did not get the same honor during the war.
Pepsi did not get the same honor during the war, and Walter Mack, who had taken over the company, was also very clever and did all kinds of things to try to promote Pepsi, but he was at a major disadvantage. So the soldiers came back from World War II with a decided preference for Coke, and also because they were the victors, they set Coke up for international conquest, and the symbolism of it being an American drink and the American soldiers' drink was quite potent.
Let's go ahead and take a call now. And Larry on from Champaign is on the line, on line one. Larry, good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning. So Coca-Cola imports under a special license coca leaves into New Jersey. Is that correct?
That's right.
So where's the coca plant grown? And does that mean there's some sort of a market for a legally grown market in Colombia or somewhere?
It's in Peru. That's right. The Peruvian government oversees it. It's all perfectly legal.
It's legal to grow it in, to grow coca leaves in Peru. Okay.
Not for everybody, but for the government to grow it, and then under their supervision, it's exported legally and it's imported legally into the U.S. for Coca-Cola. The cocaine that's produced, much of it goes into research or for medicine. It's still, I believe, used as an anesthetic during eye surgery, but most of it is destroyed.
There's just not that much market for legal cocaine, I take it.
That's right.
So I had heard that they have the largest manufacturing facility in the world for processing coca leaves. Is that the one in Peru, or are there others?
I don't know the answer to that question. The one in Maywood, New Jersey, is under a place called Stepan, Stepan Chemical Company, and it's certainly a large facility.
Because the rules around the world are different than in the United States, and maybe in the United States things are tightly controlled, but they are creating a market, and somehow there's a lot of stuff getting into the illegal industries around the world.
Certainly there's no question about that. By the way, at one point during the 1930s, Robert Woodruff flew down to Peru and started a decocainized plant down there because it wasn't clear whether Coke was going to be able to import whole coca leaf, but it turns out that he managed to lobby and get that to happen, so they never had to use their Peruvian plant.
So when you buy Mexican Coke, Coca-Cola, everybody says it tastes different and it's got a different formula. Well, what is the different in there?
It does not have a different formula. It has cane sugar instead of high fructose corn syrup, which tastes better as far as I'm concerned. So
the cane sugar tastes better?
I think cane sugar in Coca-Cola tastes better than the high fructose corn syrup that they now use in the United States. They switched from cane sugar in the mid 80s, right before the new Coke debacle, and many people, including me, would prefer cane sugar.
And I have seen stores where, for instance, they may sell the regular Coca-Cola product or other soft drinks for that matter, but I'll see perhaps in a separate display cane sugar soda products, especially if there's an area with maybe a high Hispanic Hispanic customer base.
I've had Mexican Coke imported especially into the United States for that reason.
Larry, wanted to thank you for your call. We're going to take a short break right now, but we'll be back with more about the Coca-Cola story with Mark Pendergrast, author of For God, Country, and Coca-Cola. This is Focus on WYLL. I'm Jim Meadows. We're back on Focus with Mark Pendergrast, author of For God, Country, and Coca-Cola, now out in a third revised and expanded edition from Basic Books. Mark has his own website at markpendergrast.com. You can call us with your questions and comments about Coca-Cola and soft drinks at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We're on Twitter and Facebook at Focus580. The phone number again is 333-WYLL or 1-800-222-WYLL. Mark, it occurred to me as we were talking about the cocaine history of Coca-Cola, which I'm sure the company would want us to remind people that it's not in the product nowadays. Your book is not an authorized history of Coca-Cola.
No, it's not authorized, but it's not it's fair and it's balanced and it's well researched.
Well, how much cooperation did the company provide as you gathered information, especially on tricky subjects like its past use of cocaine?
Well, they didn't provide anything about the cocaine, but they were very helpful in many other ways, and I interviewed many of the company executives, certainly during my initial research, and they let me into their archives while I was doing their initial research, although I didn't have free rein. But they would bring me things as I requested them if I knew what I was requesting. So, I have a great affection for the company. I grew up in Atlanta, Georgia, and I have various family connections. My grandmother nearly married Robert Woodruff. My grandfather was a pharmacist in Atlanta who served Coca-Cola and who actually testified in a very important Coca-Cola trial about the nicknames that people gave for Coke, which was quite funny, I found.
What sort of nicknames did Coca-Cola get from its customers?
Well, for many, many years, up through the Depression, people asked for a dope. They would go into a soda fountain and ask for a dope with lime or a dope with cherry. And they also, according to my grandfather, asked for a shot in the arm or another brick in the Candler building.
Candler being Asa Candler, the Coca-Cola executive.
Yeah, the Candler building was the first high-rise in Atlanta. It's still there. Beautiful building. They called him to testify because they were suing a company that put out a drink called Coke, K-O-K-E, and they wanted my grandfather to say that that meant Coca-Cola to him, which it did, but he also listed all these other names, which I thought was funny.
Well, let's go ahead and take another phone call. This is Nancy in Vermilion County. Good morning, Nancy, on line 4. You're on the air on Focus.
Good morning. I wonder if you would talk to the issue of changing from sugar to the high fructose corn syrup. It seems to me about a generation ago, there was a big advertising campaign to introduce new Coke, and I think it was the change from classic, called classic, which was made with sugar, and the new Coke, which was high fructose. And then when the public didn't like it, they kind of backed off. And then it seems to me over time they just simply changed the formula so that now you get Coke Classic with high fructose corn syrup with no fanfare. Is that correct?
That's not quite right. In 1984, the company switched to half high fructose corn syrup. And then when they got brave, they switched to it full time. And that was right before they changed the formula of New Coke. So people sort of confused the two of them. But New Coke wasn't about changing to high fructose corn syrup. It was about a completely new formula, which was more similar to Pepsi and which beat Pepsi in blind taste tests. You know, let me just, is it okay if I talk about New Coke for a minute?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, first off, the reason they switched to high fructose corn syrup has nothing to do with taste. They insisted the taste was the same. It's because there's a protective tariff for American sugar. If they didn't have that, then they'd still use sugar because it would be cheaper. But it's not. Corn is cheaper. And the corn lobby is unlikely to allow that to happen. It's sort of a protective tariff for corn, too. At any rate, what happened was Roberto Gazueta was the CEO of Coca-Cola. He came in 1981. He was a Cuban-American who had fled Cuba after Castro. Very smart guy. He was a chemist, and he actually knew the Coca-Cola formula. He was one of the few people in the world who did know it. But Coke had been losing market share to Pepsi for 20 years. They had had brilliant advertising that didn't help. They tried all kinds of things that didn't help. And so Gazueta, when he came in, he said, there are no sacred cows, there are no sacred formulas. But nobody believed that he would actually change the Coke formula, but he did. They came up with a drink which in blind taste tests beat Pepsi a little bit more than half the time. What they did not do was to tell people in focus groups that they were going to take away the old Coke. So when people drank the new Coke, they said, yeah, this is pretty good stuff, that's fine. But when they took away the old Coke, everybody had a complete conniption fit for about 3 months. The letters that people wrote to the company, which I have in the book, are just extraordinary. It sounded like, you know, you had killed God. And then when they brought Coke back and called it Coke Classic, the letters were equally astonishing. You know, it was like the second coming.
Well, I take it that the Coca-Cola that you drink today, not counting the diet drinks, et cetera, is the classic Coke only with corn syrup?
That's right. They dropped the name Classic a couple of years ago, finally, because New Coke died a quiet and ignominious death. So it is Coca-Cola now, just called Coca-Cola. But, you know, I predicted in the book that it's, in a few years, it's very likely that the combined market for Diet Coke and Coke Zero are going to surpass regular Coca-Cola.
Is that happening among soft drinks in general, that the diet versions are winning, so to speak?
They're growing, yes, because there's such a concern over the obesity epidemic. Mm-hmm. And the company has been absolutely pilloried by public health critics and by me for their role in the obesity epidemic, which is pretty big. And as you know, there's been a lot of controversy over taxes on soft drinks, sin taxes, so to speak, or Mayor Bloomberg's attempt to limit the size of some soft drinks. And the companies have banded together in the American Beverage Association, which has just poured millions of dollars into fighting these tax efforts, and they have succeeded in squashing them, which I think is misguided. I don't think they should be doing that.
In the meantime, to complete Nancy's question, I take it that really soft drinks in general, unless they are diet drinks, soft drinks in general in North America or in the U.S., use corn syrup instead of cane sugar. And is that likely to continue?
Yes, in the United States, unless the economics change.
Okay. Nancy, thank you very much for your question on that. And I'm wondering, with the whole thing with New Coke is they were trying to compete with Pepsi. You were telling me that Pepsi started out as being the cheap cola, as not really being that good a cola, yet a few decades later, it was beginning to crowd Coke in the market. What happened during all that time to Pepsi Cola?
Well, there's a guy named Al Steele, a really colorful character who used to work for Coca-Cola and who got fired because he publicly brought his mistress to Atlanta, which didn't go down well with the conservative South. Would have been okay if he'd had his mistress quietly, but he was pretty loud about it. So Al Steele revolutionized Pepsi by bringing it out of the kitchen and into the living room, as it was put in those. You know, people used to buy Pepsi, and in their kitchen they would surreptitiously pour it into Coke bottles and then bring them out into the living room to serve guests. So Al Steele sponsored some early television ads called the Sociables campaign, portraying Pepsi as this high-quality product. And then there was some brilliant advertising after Steele died of a heart attack in 1959, but his widow, Joan Crawford, the actress who had actually advertised for Coke during the 30s, she became a big spokesman for Pepsi also.
Okay.
But they came up with great ads. You remember Come Alive, You're in the Pepsi Generation.
I'm just old enough, yes. I remember... Actually, what I remember specifically, my earliest Pepsi ad, I think, was a lyric set to the song Making Whoopee. And I think the line at that time was, for those who think young.
That's right. So Pepsi made a concerted effort to segment the market, really, to appeal to young people. Here were the baby boomers coming up. And they did a brilliant job of doing that. Coca-Cola was kind of caught because... they wanted to appeal to absolutely everyone. They'd been very successful at doing that. But they've been pushed over the years by Pepsi to address, you know, to try to be more hip. And I think that when they do that, they are trying too hard. I prefer the old-fashioned, heartwarming Coca-Cola ads like the Mean Joe Green commercial or the Hilltop commercial to the, you know, them trying to use rappers and hip-hop and stuff like that.
The Hilltop commercial was, of course, that Hilltop full of young people singing I'd Like to Buy the World a Coke, which
yeah,
became
people,
a top 40 song.
It came out in 1971, and people forget why and how it came out, but it was truly, they were trying to appeal to everybody. You know, the Vietnam War was raging, and the controversy over it was raging. So you had Dove versus Hawk, you had the older generation versus the hippies, and here was an ad that grew out of the... First, they introduced the real thing, which you started your program with. And that was a very successful attempt to appeal to people who were conservative and traditional, who wanted the real thing, authentic thing, but also to hippies who, you know, wanted to do their own thing and be real. So the Hilltop commercial showed young people dressed in a native garb, all holding a Coca-Cola like a talisman of religion or peace, singing how they'd like to buy the world a Coke and keep it company, and everybody should be happy and be peaceful. It was a kind of an absurd message that Coca-Cola could somehow or other make the world more peaceful, but it was very effective because it's what people want.
And the lyrics were reworked to not reference Coca-Cola and became a top 40 hit.
Yeah, the New Seekers made it a great hit. Every time people listened to it, even though it didn't say Coca-Cola, it was evocative of Coca-Cola.
The soda publicity you can't buy, I guess.
That's right. They did something similar quite recently with the song Waving Flag by Canaan.
I'm sorry, I don't have that one handy, but that worked in the same way, is that they took a song which was then taken back as they created
they
a...
They took a song that was originally a hit song, and they paid the singer, who is from Somalia, to rework the song to be a Coca-Cola anthem, and then they paid him to go around the world. This was just a few years ago.
Okay.
This is in the new edition.
Let me go to another phone call, and this is line one. Steve in Urbana, you've been waiting patiently. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Hello. Before I ask my question, I have a little quick anecdote. I happened to have an old Life magazine ad from about 1950 Joan Crawford pushing Royal Crown Cola. I just thought I'd mention that.
She's done all brands, apparently.
Yeah, not to mention every brand of cigarettes. But my question is, I totally agree about Mexican Coke. I discovered that to my pleasure during my first trip to Mexico, and I thought, my goodness, this is how Coke used to taste when I was growing up. I couldn't believe it. And so when I years later now, I've moved to Urbana, I was happy to see that the county market carries the bottles, individual bottles of the Mexican Coke for about $1.20. And I occasionally buy one of those because it's, and then I sort of nurse it, you know, I make it last. And so that's why I wanted, you mentioned that you order, special order your Mexican Coke. I was wondering if there's anything on your website that gives an address or for that.
No, I don't special order it. I said some stores do special order it.
But I mean, you. I thought you said you sent away for when you wanted it, your supply of.
Nope. The last time I had it was someplace in California, a high-end coffee shop.
Well, you
By
can't
the way, I want to give a shout out to the University of Champaign-Urbana. I was there about 2 months ago, I guess, to talk about my coffee book. And it's just a really nice place, and everybody was so nice to me, and I had dinner with all the students, so it's funny that everybody seems to be calling from there.
Yeah. Oh, one more quick question, and I'll hang up. Very garish, inaccurate movie made about Joan Crawford, Mommy Dearest. There's a scene in there where Mr. Steele dies, and they assume Joan Crawford is on the board, and the board just assumes that Joan Crawford will just sort of leave this picture. She's just a figurehead. Well, then there's this big scene after he dies where she barges into the board meeting and says, I won't use the word that she said, I'll say, don't screw with me, fellas.
Mm-hmm.
Is any of that accurate? That she, in other words, she wanted to be still, you know,
I think a member
of the board of Pepsi, or would you
it's
not?
Certainly accurate. It's certainly accurate that she was a very powerful figure for Pepsi.
Yeah.
On the board for many years to come. I don't
did a lot of traveling and worked very hard. I mean, she was put in a lot of.
I will tell you, there's a great. Let me tell you this terrific anecdote.
Okay.
About Joan Crawford. Billy Wilder made a terrific film called 1-2-3, starring James Cagney in 1961 or 62, right after the Berlin Wall went up. Jimmy Cagney played a Coca-Cola executive who wanted to go into the Soviet Union, and his boss wouldn't let him do it. It's a very funny send-up of a lot of things, and I quoted from it in the book. So when I was doing the first edition, Billy Wilder was still alive, and I interviewed him. And he had a German accent. And I asked him about the last scene in the movie where Jimmy Cagney is pulling out something from a Coke machine, and it's a Pepsi, and he holds it up with horror. And that's the last thing in the film you see is Cagney holding a Pepsi. And he said, oh yes, that happened because Joan Crawford called me up, and she was bitching and moaning about how could I make this whole film about Coca-Cola. So I put that in to make her happy.
Okay. Well, Steve, thank you very much for your call. And we do have another caller on the line. Still a few minutes left to get your comments or questions about Coca-Cola in as we talk to Mark Pendergrast, the author of For God, Country, and Coca-Cola. You can talk to us at 333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-5455. Or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. On line two, Linda at Savoy, good morning. You're on the air on Focus.
Sure. I kind of got off the thread that you're on, but I wanted to mention that and maybe your author knows about this, but in Monterrey, Mexico, in downtown Monterrey, there is a 15, 20-story building with the outline of a Coke bottle on the side. It's very, very impressive to see that bottle.
Okay.
Thank you. I was not aware of that. One of the things I did say in the book was that when they built the Empire State Building, The top of the building was at one point going to be in the shape of the Coca-Cola bottle, but that did not happen. Also, when the Statue of Liberty was going in, people, this was just when Coke was being invented. It wasn't Coca-Cola, but it was part of the sort of zeitgeist that people were competing. They wanted to put commercials on it. another one of my favorite stories is sometime after World War II, a guy was this purportedly being driven across the Sahara Desert, and he asked, when would they come to the limits of civilization? And the driver said, well, it depends on how you define that. What do you mean? And he said, well, when will we not be able to get a Coca-Cola? And he said, never.
I'm wondering, in Atlanta, the hometown of Coca-Cola, are there any big building landmarks or advertising displays that are really notable for Coca-Cola?
Well, there are ads for Coke all over the place. There's the World of Coca-Cola Museum, which is a very big tourist draw, in which they – and Emory University is called Coca-Cola University because the company and its executives have given them so much money over the years. So it's kind of hard to go anywhere in Atlanta without seeing evidence of Coca-Cola. And its largesse, you know, has helped Atlanta in many, many ways. Parks and big public projects all have Coca-Cola money put into them. They moved the formula, by the way, at the end of 2011 to a vault inside the World of Coca-Cola Museum. And I think this is an absolutely brilliant thing they did. They have a really, really over-the-top presentation that you go into this sort of Holy of Holies room, and there's an announcer who in a low voice says, "You are here. The formula is near." And then you go through this whole thing. And if you go to YouTube and you look up my name and Coca-Cola Vault, look up Mark Pendergrass, Coca-Cola Vault, you'll find a little digital video I made when I was there.
Now, the thing in is... Go ahead, but... The thing I was going to think is the formula, which is presented but yet not shown with such great drama at the world at the Coca-Cola Museum, is at least reputedly on page 487 and 88 of your book.
Oh, it's on 491. Is that there's a facsimile, a new facsimile?
Absolutely, yes. Because you found another version of it. Which one is closer, do you think, to the secret Coca-Cola formula?
I think that the first one that I found in the Coca-Cola archives that just had a big X on it is probably a little bit closer. The one that I have the facsimile of, which is in the handwriting of Frank Robinson, whose handwriting you see all over the world. He's the one who wrote out Coca-Cola in the logo. That one is confusing to me because it has two different forms of nutmeg in it. It has fluid extract of nutmeg, and then it has oil of nutmeg, essential oil. So it confuses me.
Now
they're both very, very close to one another, and they're both very old, and they both have fluid extract of coca leaf.
Now this really raises a question. It's their secret formula, but you found it in the company archives in which you were let in, and you printed it. You first printed it 20 years ago, but they're still
That's
parading
right.
it around as their secret formula.
Well, you know, I think that Pemberton made a formula, and he made Coca-Cola one way. Then when Asa Candler took over in 1888 and Frank Robinson took the formula to him, they reputedly modified it somewhat, which may account for the slight difference between the two. Then they had to cut the caffeine in half as a result of that government lawsuit. They replaced citric acid with phosphoric acid. They replaced cane sugar with high fructose corn syrup. So the formula they've got in their vault, if it's the original formula, is not what they're using now. So, you know, at the end of this whole little formula section that I have as an appendix in the book, I quoted a really interesting conversation I had with a Coke spokesman about this. I said, well, what if I found the original formula and put it in my book? And he said, well, okay, let's pretend that I have it here in my desk. Here, what are you going to do with it?
And I said, well, I'll put it in my book, and he said, it'll be a bestseller. And he said, good, good. Then what? And I said, well, maybe somebody will make it. And he said, okay, what are they going to call it? Can't call it Coca-Cola because we'd sue them. And how are they going to distribute it? We have the world's best distribution system. How are they going to price it? How are they going to advertise it? And he basically said, we could care less whether somebody else has the formula because we've been building the brand equity of this product for well over a century. And so the point really is not the formula. The point is the mystique and what the drink means to people.
Well, we're going to have to stop our conversation there, and our apologies for the waiting caller. But we've been talking today with Mark Pendergrast, author of For God, Country, and Coca-Cola, now in its third edition in trade paperback from Basic Books. And Mark's own website is markpendergrast.com. And Mark, thank you very much for being on Focus today.
Thank you. And people can write to me from my website, by the way.
For if you have any more comments or questions, markpendergrast.com is the place to go to contact the author of For God, Country, and Coca-Cola. We welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website, at will.illinois.edu/focus. Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon. Other members of our Focus team are Pam Dempsey and Kimberly Cronick. And Jason Croft is our technical director today, handling your calls. Tomorrow on Focus, you can vacation in Europe next summer. We'll be talking about things to see and do in Illinois with Sue Post, the author of Hiking Illinois, and Heather Wilkins of the Land of Lincoln Regional Tourism Office. That's on Tuesday's show. This is Focus on WYLL.